I'd be lying if I said there was lots of summer left, because obviously there isn't. But there's still some. There's still a little time to sit at the counter and have some lemonade. Not that I would have any, frankly. There's way too much sugar in that stuff. I'll take some coffee. And there's plenty of that here. It's The Diner for Friday, September 1st, 2006. Welcome. It's not that I don't like lemonade. I love lemonade. But they add a half a cup of sugar to every glass here. There's more sugar than lemon. And Splenda has not exactly made it out to these parts yet. If it has, it's been turned away. I don't think they trust it. I read an article somewhere. It was based on chlorine. Chlorine's for laundry day and not for your sodas. If they do have any artificial sweeteners here at the diner, I think it comes from old discontinued army surplus leaking cans of cyclamate that I've seen. And that stuff, it tastes like you're licking the tire of a car in a Dow Chemical parking lot. Thank you. I think I'll stick with my coffee. Coffee's fine by me. Let's see what's on the menu today, the chalkboard menu by the door. Halibut British style. I have no idea what that means. What is British style? Could mean that the waitress just goes back to the chef and asks for an halibut. Wouldn't put it past her. I haven't even done the introduction yet, have I? Just babbling on again as usual. Well, hello, folks. Hi there. Welcome. Bienvenue. I'm James Lilac, sitting at my accustomed place at the long boomerang pattern formica counter here at the diner out on Old Highway 23, which at this moment is probably about 18 and a half minutes from wherever you happen to be at the moment. And I have to confess, I'm somewhat in the doldrums. And when I say I'm in the doldrums, I say that with the given context that I am a member, a happy, lucky resident of the most prosperous free society that has ever existed in the history of mankind. And so when I say that I'm in the doldrums or depressed about something, it's in context, right? Some guy's got it worse. There's somebody right now in Equatorial New Guinea who's pulling a 9-foot filament worm out of his foot, okay? I got it better than him. Just saying. But in that context, there's something about this date that just brings the heart down a little. September 1st. That's the end of summer. I know. Meteorologically, summer's not over. Why, we have 2 to 3 weeks of wonderful summer left ahead of us. The skies will be limpid. The temperature's clement. The trees won't even begin to give you a hint that they're going to turn. Some of the loveliest time of the year. But it ain't summer. I'm sorry. Calendrical summer ends on August 31st. That the guillotine blow comes down, and that's it. Summer's done. Maybe not for you. Maybe you don't think so. But for people like me, who apparently look at the world like it's some little golden book of seasons, that's what it is. One season for every page. I mean, you know, the spring page always has the tulips coming up in the rain. The spring starts on April 1st, and then you turn the page over, and there's June 1st, and it's always some fluffy spaniel running around in a field chasing a butterfly or something with a yellow sun up in the sky, and then you turn the page again, and what do you have? Well, you wouldn't, because it's the facing page, unless, of course, never mind. And then you have September 1st, fall begins, which is always signified by kids going off to school with books strung around their back by a strap, heading toward a tiny, infinitesimally small one-room schoolhouse with a steeple and a bell in the distance. And then you turn the page. Again, if it was a facing page. No, never mind. December 1st, as I meant to say, is when winter begins. Old man winter comes in. Now he's an angry old son of a bitch. Who can blame him? Anyway, we're not there yet. We're in that wonderful little transition period, which I love. And there are two things that reward us for the end of summer. The first, of course, is an event of pomp, majesty, and almost religious significance, and I remember it from my childhood, frankly. It was one of those things that made me feel like I was part of something special. Something vitally important. The Jerry Lewis Labor Day Telethon. I thought that was the hippest thing there was. I thought it was utterly swank. It defined swank for me. I think because of the presence of Ed McMahon. I'm serious. Not that Ed McMahon himself seemed particularly swank or hip, but Ed McMahon sat next to Johnny Carson. All right, and Johnny Carson was the hippest, swankest guy on the planet. So I imagine that whatever hipness Ed had absorbed by sitting at the right hand of Johnny, it would have been concentrated, I think, in his left arm and shoulder blade, that he would bring that hipness and swankness to whatever event he was. So to see Jerry Lewis there, or to see Ed McMahon at the Jerry Lewis telethon, sort of by implication, contained a certain amount of Carson cool. I was 11. What do you want? Well, before I go on with more fascinating recollections of seeing Jerry Lewis smoke a cigarette in 1971, let's play some summer songs. There have to be some summer songs left here in the jukebox. Yes. Yes, there are.
Summer's over, the cotton he's picking now. It's over, the harvest is coming, and summer's over, the wind keeps us singing low. It's over, the chilly wind's waiting calls.
Oh, to hell with you guys. That was a waste of a nickel. Here, let's try another one. A6. Ah, now that's summery.
Seagull cries on rain-swept beaches, tear-washed eyes and pain love teaches remind me summer is gone.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Empty lovers' lanes are lonely. Bittersweet refrains will only remind me summer has gone.
I should know better than to trust Doris Day. Chick's a total bring down. Well, there has to be something pro-summer here in the jukebox. Come on. Here's something I haven't seen before. It's a group called The Stimulators. From 1956, it's The Stimulators with Warm Summer Nights. Here at the diner, it's jukebox pick number D4. Where did that come from?
Summer's gone and all the leaves have fallen from the tree. I did a wrong and now my love has gone away from me. My little bird has made her fly, all because I didn't treat her right. Now that she's gone, all I'm longing for are those warm summer nights. Warm summer nights.
All right. I think I get the message. The jukebox is speaking to me. Summer's over. Deal with it, guy. What could cheer me up? Well, of course, some Ed McMahon swank. But what are the chances we have any of that in the jukebox here? All right, I'm just going to punch up some summer-killing music at random here. Z12.
Into a little girl's room one night, her father tiptoed to put out the light. He bent down to kiss her and then tuck her in tight. And he sang to her softly a song of good night. Beautiful girl, lying there, ribbons of velvet in your hair. Sleep like an angel, little girl blue. Wherever you are, I will watch over you.
May a diseased crooner die. die in your yurt.
Into that room one dark night, he came in a uniform, shining and bright. He had to leave now and couldn't say why, but softly he sang a song of goodbye. Beautiful girl.
What do you mean he couldn't say why? She's asleep. I assume that he knows why. He got his orders, knows where he's being deployed. It's not a total mystery to him. It's not like he woke up one day and said, gosh, I'm in a uniform, I wonder how that happened.
And when it is done, then I'll come home to you. In a jungle outpost, far away, a soldier was writing a letter one day, telling his girls he was missing them so, and signing with kisses a daddy's hello.
Ah!
A little girl tossed in her bed that night. She wanted her daddy to tuck her in tight. A wind touched the curtains and sighed as it blew. And a voice seemed to whisper to someone it knew. Beautiful girl.
Okay, if Dad gets taken out by Charlie by the end of this song, I am not forgiving Ed McMahon. Not at all.
Sleep like an angel, little girl blue. Wherever you are, I will watch over you.
Watch over you.
Oh, thank God. The soldier made it out of the Saccharine Story song. That's good. Because the mortality rate on those things was high. Especially if there was some sort of painful irony involved. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Although I am depressed to find out that Ed did not bring any swank to the show. Dang. And summer's still ending. What am I going to do? I know. I'll do what the pros do. I'll break for a commercial.
Chesterfield was first to name its ingredients. Ingredients that give you the best possible smoke. Now Chesterfield is first to give you scientific facts in support of smoking.
Nose, throat, and accessory organs not adversely affected by smoking Chesterfields. First such report published about any cigarette.
A responsible consulting organization reports a study by a competent medical specialist and staff on the effects of smoking Chesterfields. For 6 months, a group of men and women smoked only Chesterfield. 10 to 40 a day, their normal amount. 45% of the group have smoked Chesterfields from 1 to 30 years, for an average of 10 years each. At the beginning and end of the 6 months, each smoker was given a thorough examination, including x-rays, and covering the sinuses, nose, ears, and throat. After these examinations, the medical specialist stated,
"It is my opinion that the ears, nose, throat, and accessory organs of all participating subjects examined by me were not adversely affected in the 6 months period by smoking the cigarettes provided."
Remember this report, and buy Chesterfields either way you like them. Regular or king size.
In the summertime, when the weather is high, you can stretch right up and touch the sky. When the weather's fine, you got women on your mind. Have a drink, have a drive. Go out and see what you can find. If a daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If a daddy's poor, just do what you feel. Speed along the lane, you can turn or return at 25. When the sun goes down, you can make it good and really buy.
I'm almost ready now.
When
Sorry about that. That's just one of those quintessential summer songs from my childhood. I wonder who listened to the first version they did and said, "Needs cowbell? No. Needs somebody going ugh." And so they recut it with somebody going ugh every other beat, and that wasn't just quite enough. So somebody had to do a pfft in the background. Mungo Jerry. So named after Jerry got the mung, I believe. They probably dreamed of the day where they were all backstage at Pink Floyd at some festival, you know, in the Isle of Man or something. Got the chance to walk up to Roger Waters and say, hey, you know, people look at us and they say, which one of you is Jerry? Just like they look at you guys and say, which one's Pink? Because we're all rock stars, man. I think they're still touring. Seriously, they're still doing jug band festivals somewhere in Western England. Most people don't know because they haven't given it much thought and it's too horrible notion to consider, but most people don't know that there was a whole album full of Mungo Jerryosity. They even had a follow-up hit. And oh, it's so much different than In the Summertime. Well, that's enough of that. Look, I've come to terms with the fact that summer's over. It's been a wonderful summer. I've no reason to complain. It's had everything that I wanted. It's had fireworks. It's had trips. It's had highway vacations. It's been perfect. It has yet to have the sanctification of Jerry Lewis singing You'll Never Walk Alone. Is that what he sings at the end of the Muscular Dystrophy? And I'm sure somebody has pointed this out, somebody with a more finely tuned sense of irony than myself. But, you know, for a disease that attacks the muscles responsible for locomotion, maybe you'll never walk alone is not the... Well, never mind. No, there's something else this summer. There's something else that really comes at the end and makes you feel happy that the summer has come to a conclusion. Because, frankly, after what we here in Minnesota have at summer's end, there's really no reason for summer to go on, because it simply cannot get any better. You know what I'm talking about. Of course you know what I'm talking about. And of course there's a song for it. But it's not the song you think.
The sun is a-shining to welcome the day. Hi-ho, come to the fair. The folks are all singing so merry and gay. Hi-ho, come to the fair. All the stalls on the green are so fine as can be, with trinkets and tokens so pretty to see. So it's come then, maidens and men, to the fair in the bright of the morning. So deck yourselves out in your finest array, with a hi-ho, come to the fair. The trumpets are playing a tune that you know, and the drum is a-beating away. Let us go. They'll be racing and chasing from morning till night, with the roundabouts turning from left into right. So it's come then, maidens and men, to the fair, to the bright of the morning. So lock up your house, there'll be plenty of fun. I hope come to the fair.
Uh-oh, some really cheerful-looking guy has just sat down next to me.
I'm Hugh Hewitt, and I want salmon.
Well, too bad, because today's special is halibut.
Who wants halibut when you can have salmon?
If it's lovemaking, dear, that you have in your mind.
Hi-ho, come to the fair.
Salmon!
Oh, your heart will be happy and loving and kind.
Hi-ho, come to the fair.
If it's haste to the wedding, should play. I know that you dance to the end of the day. So come then, maidens and men, to the fair, to the bride of the morning. The sun is a shining to welcome the day. With a high ho, come to the fair, maidens and men, come to the fair. So deck yourselves out in your finest array. High ho, come to the fair.
Salmon.
There isn't any salmon. There's halibut. What an annoying fellow. Anyway, that song, sung so fetchingly, was called Come to the Fair. Ah, but which fair? I don't think she was talking about any county fair. I think she was talking about the World's Fair. And you may well ask, well, which World's Fair? The 93, the 07, the 33, the 39? The 39, I believe. The 1933 Chicago World's Fair was pretty cool, but it somehow gets lost in the shuffle of 1930s expositions, of which I believe there were about 15. The one we remember is the 1939 World's Fair in New York. Because that was the apogee, the acme of modernity. It had those signature elements, the trilon and the perisphere, that would be the big round thing and the tall, pointy thing, that seemed to point the way to what the future would be like very soon, as we whopped old man depression, we would have a world that would be white and clean and streamlined and rational and mechanized and industrial and planned from above by benevolent technocrats. It's going to be great. Of course, it didn't quite work out that way, and one of the reasons that we look back on the fair with such poignance now is not because of its beauty, and it was a beautiful thing, was because looking back at them in 1939, they had no idea what sort of hell they were about to go through, and when they came out at the other end of it, they didn't get the modern world they were promised. Or did they? Actually, you could make the case that they did. We did get the 8-lane freeways barreling through the middle of the city. And believe me, to sell that to somebody in those days would have been no problem, because it would have gone through blight and would have provided wonderful ways to get your car into the city, and people like their cars. So you got that. We got the high-rises downtown, too. We got the featureless international-style high-rises as well. What's most interesting is that when you look at the urban planning that they had in those days from the Futurama movie, which is available online somewhere, go find it, I can't do all your work, you'll find that what it thought would be the ideal environment for people to live in, that is to say, large tall towers isolated from one another, separated by vast expanses of grass and parkway, that the middle class didn't live there, the rich people didn't live there. The vision of the future in Futurama ended up being the vision for the poor. It ended up being where everybody put the poor, because those were the only people on whom you could really socially experiment, because they were the most malleable when it came to, you know, not having any choice in the matter. So, there's not a lot of the future at the fair here in Minnesota. And we don't refer to any particular fair either. I mean, nobody talks about the 1986 Minnesota State Fair. For that matter, it's almost erroneous to talk about the 1939 World's Fair, because they held it over for another year. It was actually also the 1940 World's Fair. So if you missed it last year, come on in and help us recoup our extraordinary operating costs. You know, pay no attention to the fact that the Italian booth seems to have shuttered and moved away. No, the Minnesota State Fair knows not the year, the time, the date. It just simply arrives, sets up, and then after 10 days, as far as we can tell, it melts into the ground. Over the course of the year, if you want, there are certain events that take place on the state fairgrounds, and you can go and sort of drive through the state fair, which seems like an odd and peculiar privilege. Oh, although I've had it more than once. Frankly, once. One time. I had an all-access pass, actually, to the state fair, which was just got me everywhere, and I had access to a scooter, or an electrical cart of sorts. And we would, this was back when I was doing radio at KSTP, we would drive around hither and yon with just flashing the pass, and up would go the gates. We'd be able to drive into the secret areas. We're sort of looking for something secret, to stumble upon the cabal that ran the fair, perhaps, to make a wrong turn into a building and find animals sitting there with spats and top hats smoking cigars laughing about the humans or something like that, and find out it was all actually some grand experiment on behalf of our animal overlords. Ah, they think every year we give the rubes the old barn thing, and they think they're in charge. And what came of this at the end, though, was humiliation, because we set up the little cart, the radio transmitter, and we were going to do the radio show driving around the state fair, just zipping through the crowds, which sounded like a grand idea. And we were out there doing the show, and I'm talking to people, I'm putting the wireless mic, and da-da-da-da-da. It never occurred to us, maybe, that we ought to include, a radio to see whether or not we were actually going out over the air. And as it turns out, we weren't. It had to go to endless PSAs and commercials until we were stupid enough to realize that we'd gone beyond the transmitter range and should get back to the booth, which we did. Ah, yes, that was the Fair of 86. I'll never forget about it. People still talk about it, in fact. Fair of 86. Ah, but I joke. Ha, 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 as is my way. Actually, there is something about the 1988 Minnesota State Fair that I recall. I was working for the Pioneer Press, and my assignment was to go to the fair every damn day and find something to write about. And there is, but it's generally indistinguishable from last year and the year to come. Oh, every year they'll send somebody out to do the Daily Beat, but they always end up interviewing May Anderson from Painesville. There's a great-sounding city for you. Painesville, right next to Agony Town. And she's there with her husband. They come once a year. They've been coming since 53. They like the sheep. And you duly report it. But I was trying to find something different. And so I did one piece on Daybreak and one piece on Twilight. Daybreak is interesting at the State Fair because it belongs to the people who work there. It belongs to the industrious young souls from 4-H who've come up from the farms and are thrilled to be in the city and generally dazzled and impressed, but by the same time rather laconic and disinclined to let on that they find themselves a bit abashed to be among city folk. And why should they, frankly? They know more than we do. They know about cows. They know how to raise them. They know how to kill them. And in between, they know how to keep them alive. And they will come up with their large, lowing, cud-chewing, ruminant charges and stay with them in the barns, and then get up early in the morning and go have breakfast at one of the number of places around the fair where you can get a good, hearty, working man's breakfast. And by that, I mean pancakes. Pancakes the size of tractor tires. I mean sausages the size, of your forearm. Good, sturdy breakfasts that are put out for the people who actually have to work, as opposed to the people who are just going to wander around and shove food in their face that's attached to a stick. So I wrote about that. And I enjoyed that because I was absolutely exhausted having gotten up at daybreak to see exactly what the fair was like when the cock crowed. And it's great. It's clean. It's fresh. It's dewy. And it's uncontaminated by all the people who will stagger through with their large pendulous bellies protruding against a shirt with a motto that's vaguely obscene and a hat turned on backwards and a wife whose shirt says I'm with stupid even though she didn't really pick it out herself. No, the fair by itself, when it's left to the people who run it, be they Carney or be they 4-H, is a wonderful place to be. Which brings me to the other part of the piece. I did one about Daybreak and one about Twilight. As wonderful and clean and forthright and wholesome as fair at Daybreak may be, it's nothing like the fair at Twilight, which is when the fair really truly comes into its own. The sky deepens, the lights pop on, and that's when you sort of detect the great seething, yelling, shouting, fluorescent carnality of the Midway. And there's nothing better than being a teen on your own with your peers going to the fair, to the Midway, to ride, to get into the zipper with your buddies and to scream as you're tossed into the heavens and to bang heads and to throw up on each other's laps. It's absolutely wonderful. And I think now that I think about it, I think this actually was not a diptych but a triptych of pieces because I did one about the fair closing because after everything's closed, again, it comes into its own. The people who run the place, the people who work there, retake possession of the fairgrounds away from the transitory occupants who've been streaming through for the last 12 hours. And I've always had a fascination with fairs after they're closed. When I was a little kid, there was something called the Imagination Festival in Fargo down at Island Park. And since I worked for it as a strapping 14-year-old, I got to hang around after everything was closed. And there was something about the autumnal light and the being in the park and the rustling of the leaves and the closed tents that made you feel part of something. Even though it was over, you had a secret bit of information. You weren't quite sure exactly what it was, but it was yours, and it was secret. And you have the same feeling when you're walking around the fair at night when everything's shuttered and closed. You belong to it in a way that the people who stand there under the glaring blare of noon don't. So I love the fair. Love it. But it closes on Labor Day. And when it's done, as I said before, you can feel the wind of the whistling blade as it heads toward your neck. As I wrote a long time ago, because I've been writing about the fair for 20 years, simply because it's a wonderful thing to write about, for heaven's sake. So many things, so much color, so much grease, so much humanity, that some years you go back from the fair and you've been there since 1, 2 o'clock or so. You know, when the sun was coming down at 1 or 2, it was a little hot, a little sweaty. Day was kind of humid. But as the day wore on and the sun went down, a chill came in. And by the time you got to your car, you were wishing that you'd had a jacket. And when you get in the car, you turn on the heater. You turn on the heater and the windows fog. And even though technically it's summer, you know, it's done. That's okay, Jerry. We'll pick it up next year. And that's that for this ad hoc impromptu iteration of The Diner. Thank you for dropping by, folks. I'm James Lilex. This has been The Diner for Friday, September 1st, 2006. We'll see you down the road.
Salmon.